Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today we'll be talking with Paul Mackenzie Jones about his new biography of the Native American activist Clyde Warrior, entitled Clyde Warrior, Tradition, Community, and Red Power. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Yes, certainly. Originally, I was born and raised in Liverpool, England. And I came over to the States in 2005 for graduate school. And I have been here ever since. I got my PhD at the University of Oklahoma, and now I am in Montana as an assistant professor of Native Americans. Okay.
And how is it that you came to write a book about Clyde Warrior?
Well, when I first came into Oklahoma, I wanted to study Native American history because I did American studies as an undergraduate and as a master's level. And we covered a whole range of different ethnicities and histories as part of that, but American Indians were always left out. And I always found that odd considering they were the original people of the continent. So, like, I knew I wanted to study American Indian history, but I didn't really know what about American Indian history I wanted to study. I was lucky enough to find myself under the tutelage of a Warren Metcalf, who ended up being my dissertation advisor. And he gave me a load of a list of books on contemporary or 20th century U.S. history. And as I started to read those books, Clyde Warrior, when we got to the 50s and 60s and the American Indian movement, which most people are familiar with, at least to some degree of in terms of American Indian activism, Clyde Warrior's name kept popping up in these books where people would say, various authors and historians and sociologists would describe him as being important and significant, and yet no one had ever written about him. And so I thought, well, that's the sort of type of person I am. Well, if he's so important and he's so significant, why hasn't anyone written about him? And so I decided, well, I will, if no one else has. And that's what started me on the, that's what started me on the journey. So it started off as a master's thesis and then a doctoral dissertation and then the book. So it was from beginning idea until the book itself, probably 9 years of study and research.
Wow. And one of the things that I noticed in your bibliography was that it wasn't just a matter of looking at Clyde Warrior's writings and the context of the history, but you interviewed a lot of people who knew him, people who worked alongside with him, people who participated in various organizations that he became an activist in. So it really is not just a biography of him based upon the historical record, but also you've met with these people who knew him when he was a vibrant, active human being.
Yeah, and it sort of it made it it kept me much more honest in my writing, I think, as well as having those people, them trusting me with those stories. And at first, it allowed me to see Clyde as in a much more three-dimensional manner, rather than just reading him from pages and reading his own writing. I got to speak to people who knew him and people who loved him, and including family members. And it really made my writing much more honest in that I knew once the book is finished, it's not just there as an historical record, and it's not just there to be read and discussed by other historians, but it was also going to be read and reviewed by those people who had trusted me with those stories. And his family members got to read it before I finished the book. Before the book was actually published, they became part of the sort of the production process. And I would go to them and say, I want you to approve this before it goes out to the general public, because I don't want anything out there that you don't approve of, because you trusted me with these stories. But it did. It really helped without those stories, it would have been a completely, you know, a completely different book entirely.
Now, when you begin the book, you don't begin by talking about Clyde Warrior. You begin by talking about the background of his tribe. And as you make it clear throughout the book, it's very important to understand that background, to understand who Clyde Warrior is and why he did the things that he did. And I was wondering if you could explain to us a bit about his tribe and sort of the context of the American Indian, for lack of a better word, activist community prior to the 1950s.
Yes, certainly. And again, that's one of the things that struck me as I was, you know, when I first started encountering his name, oftentimes the description that would lead into a discussion of him was that he was traditionally raised Ponca Indian. And really, that there would be no further explanation of what that meant. So, you know, it's then left up to the reader to imagine what exactly a traditionally raised Ponca Indian is, or how, you know, what that means in terms of identity or culture or heritage or history. And so I thought it was important to start with the history of his nation, because that then gives, you know, if you're going to talk about who he was and how much it is important to him to be a, you know, traditionally raised or culturally immersed Ponca Indian, then you need to really understand at least a basic framework of what being a Ponca Indian meant, not just in the present time, but also in the past. And that includes sort of encounters with European settlement and encroachment, and how they ended up coming from Nebraska to Oklahoma, and the trouble and turmoil that was involved in that process. was part of the process with the Ponca specifically, were because of their particular circumstances. Congress in 1800, in the 1880s. Approved funding for the Ponca to buy the land, so their reservation as such, and there's an argument as to whether or not the reservation exists in Oklahoma. You know, the terminology changed, and people talk about agencies rather than reservations, and so on a technical legal term, there are no reservations in Oklahoma, but there are, you know, tribal communities in Oklahoma. But the Ponca were given money by the federal government, or in exchange for the land they lost in Nebraska when they were forcibly moved into, well, what was then Indian territory, Congress approved money for them to actually physically purchase the land upon which they sat. And then years later, when the allotment process started, which was the federal government went through a process of literally cutting up the reservations into individual allotted land ownerships, and the Ponca refused because the Ponca said, we actually physically own this land. It's not yours to do this with. And the government said, well, we're going to do it anyway. And this sort of fostered a sense of not resentment as much, but a cultural and political resilience against the processes of Americanization that the federal government kept trying to push onto, you know, indigenous peoples. And so this is sort of the framework upon which, you know, within which Warrior himself was raised. And as he says himself, that, you know, even as late as 1924, which is when the federal government bestowed citizenship on American Indians, and, you know, not all Native people wanted citizenship, there were still soldiers stationed on the Ponca territory in White Eagle, which is the Ponca as an agency, I suppose, rather than reservation. And so, you know, this was all. We tend to think of these things as ancient history, but the people who are living, you know, it's recent history, because most of the people living in these reservations or agencies have grandparents alive who, or great grandparents who were physically present in these moments. And so, you know, he was raised in the late 1930s, so he's only a generation behind sort of soldiers being there, his parents and his grandparents physically, you know, experienced these situations. And so, yeah, they're a very culturally entrenched community, the Ponca, even now, and a lot of it comes from this, you know, forced removal and other, you know, the situations where they were forcibly, you know, to allot their land, even though they owned the land that they were on.
You describe
that's
that
just the political.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say,
and that's really just.
I was going to say that you described the sort of the political and economic status as well, but you also have this fascinating discussion of the cultural undermining of Ponca culture and Native American culture as well. And you had this very relevant discussion of the dances. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the Huthuska Society and what was happening there in terms of the 1920s and the 1930s, because that comes to play a very large role and arguably is the point at which Clyde Warrior really begins to assert himself culturally on the public stage for the first time.
Yeah. And you know, the culture and the politics are sort of, they're tied together rather than separated, but it's often difficult to sort of put them in the same conversation, so we do end up being common separated. But although processes I just described of the forcible allotment and the forcible removal, it had, and this is what I think a lot of people don't understand or don't really, you know, not so much understanders don't really ever sort of follow through. When we think of thought processes and we know about, most of us have at least a basic knowledge of things like the Trail of Tears and what have you, and we tend to just think of it as, okay, well, the people will move from here to there. And we don't think about the ramifications of that in terms of community or, you know, the sheer of actually packing up an entire community and moving them and rebuilding cultures or maintaining culture. And a lot of the practices that the Ponca practiced in Nebraska, they were hard to maintain once they were in Oklahoma. It's a completely different environment. The, you know, geographic, cultural, the soil even is different. The etc. So trying to rebuild yourself after you've been forcibly moved from one place to another, it was hard to do. And so once the place, or once they were placed in an agency, things like hunting for yourself, you know, stopped, became illegal. And so a lot of this, you know, the allotment process and the reservation era also, not say coincided, but also at the same time, as the federal government made many of the, just the very essence of being a Native American, illegal. You know, dances were made illegal, cultural, religion was made illegal, songs, boarding schools were trying to, you know, we're trying to stop the languages being spoken. So the very essence of who these communities or who these tribes were was deemed illegal by the federal government and suppressed as in as many ways as it possibly could. And so this then sees the culture start to be, you know, goes underground, so to speak, where if you're looking at it from the outside, you no longer see these dances and you no longer see these ceremonies taking place. But they're being hidden from sight, and they're being kept within families. And that's what happened with a lot of the songs and dances that, with the Ponca. Now, after, there was a lot of, Teddy Roosevelt authorized religious leaders to really go, you know, to roll out missionization of American Indians, again, at the start of the 20th century. And so there was a lot of pressure to forego what we think of as traditional, you know, religious practices and become Christian. And that in itself then had a negative impact on culture and cultural practices. And so by the end of World War One, an awful lot of Ponca people had become Christianized. The Native American Church was started by two Ponca men, which was sort of an incorporatization of slight traditional practices, you know, within a Christian setting. And then a lot, as I say, that so a lot of the dances and the ceremonies became dormant, because with the halushka, and it's a TH, but it's pronounced, you know, halushka as an L, although there are several other variations of pronunciation depending on which clan you speak to within the Ponca. Because that was a warrior society, and because of the reservation era, or the agency era had made warrior practices illegal, there was no way for young men to enter the warrior societies. And so these warrior societies became dormant. And it was only after World War II, I mean, there was some revitalization of warrior practices in World War One, but it was most common in World War Two, that as young Native American men came home from the war, many of these their nations started to revive the warrior ceremonies and warrior societies as a way of honoring them, because they had, this was a new generation who finally earned the right to be classified as warriors within the traditional way of practice. And so that's, and this is where a lot of the dances and, mm-hmm. and the songs were tied to. So he, even though he didn't serve, he was too young to, he was only a child during World War II. His uncle was a Marine in the Pacific, and when he came back, he sought the rights from those few, I think it was 16 elders who were original members of the Heluska when it had stopped practicing in the early 1900s. And he went and sought the right, his uncle Sylvester sought the right to revive the society, in the 1950s. And he was given the right to do so. And Warrior was considered such a skilled dancer that he was invited as part of the ceremony, even though he wasn't a warrior himself.
Fascinating.
And part of it, the how he had, and what I talk about in the book, I think it's in the first chapter as well, is his own history as a dancer started when he was a child, mm-hmm. because he was raised by his grandparents, and they were both fluent speakers. And they were fluent speakers despite the fact they'd both been to boarding schools which had tried to eradicate their language. So, that act of resistance in itself was they'd come back from boarding school and they were still maintaining the language and they still spoke Ponca every single day. And so every day of his life, the first words he heard were Ponca. Mm-hmm. And as one of his cousins said, at that time in Ponca, in the Ponca community, you didn't really see white people unless it was the insurance man or there was some business that you had in the city. That, 98% of your life would be other Ponca people or people from other neighboring, communities like the Kor or the Tonkawa, and so on and so forth. And so his entire worldview was a Native American worldview, a Ponca worldview, because his entire, everything around him was Ponca people speaking Ponca language, still maintaining those Ponca ceremonies, but secretly, so to speak. And so he was raised speaking Ponca. His grandfather was one of those original members of the Heluska Society, and he was a drum keeper, and he was a drum maker. And so that was his life. This is how he was raised in a very traditional way, which really we use the word traditional, but essentially he was raised in a very Ponca way.
You mentioned throughout the first part of the book is that he has a very strong and self-assured sense of his identity. He doesn't really question his Ponca-ness or Indian-ness in any way, and how that is you suggest is part of this appeal that he has to the people around him, which is that he's very self-assured, he's very comfortable with his identity, and it seems to come from this very immersive upbringing in his traditional culture.
Yeah, exactly. I think in one of his speeches, one of his articles later on, once he became an activist, and he was talking about the way that, Native people are often judged and based on issues like material poverty, But they were never, that's from our perspective. We would look, from a Western perspective, we would look in these reservations and we would see material poverty and dismiss, obviously they're not performing to the potential that we judge, in a Western world of what success is. But from his own framework, so he says he was born poor, he was raised poor, materially. But in a cultural manner, he was the richest person alive because his grandparents, spoke and sang to him every day. He was immersed in the drum-making process. And the process of making a drum, that's like a week-long process just to make one drum, as you're skinning the cow and then you're scraping the fur off and you're tanning the hide and you're making sure it doesn't dry too quickly and it's got to be stretched slowly and so on and so forth. The whole process takes a week just to make a drum. And so this was sort of how he and his siblings and his cousins were raised. And so, yeah, it gave him very much confidence that he had as a child, because he was also, until I think he said it was seventh or eighth grade, was the first time he went to a, you know, he was sent to a local sort of public school. And that was the first time that he really had any challenge to his identity. So those entirely, those first formative years, it was all about being Ponca. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of other people that he saw were his grandparents' friends, who would be either other Ponca elders, or they would be elders or singers or dancers from other communities. And so his was a completely, you know, rich cultural way of life. And so by the time he got to the stage where Western people were sort of trying to impose, you know, our sort of arbitrary system judgment upon him, he was already completely, you know, there's no way, you know, you people can be what you want, but I'm Ponca, and you're not going to make me ever be sorry for being Ponca. And he kept that going through his life. And yeah, and it was so, yeah, I think it was absolutely central to who he was, that upbringing, you know, and that sort of that cultural immersion, or the absolute sort of, you know, and it's very rare at that point in time, because there were so many external influences, boarding schools, you know, federal policies of allotment and terminations. Well, the allotments had stopped, but in the 1950s, the federal government started relocation and termination policies, in which relocation was to try and force, or to try and entice, young families off reservations and out of communities into the cities. You know, it was all about assimilation, trying to assimilate them into into, you know, a make Americanization. Mm-hmm. And so every which way that American Indians looked, there was an assault on their culture, or there was challenges, or they were being told persistently, you should not be Indian anymore. You need to be American. Your way of life is dead. Your way of life is past. You know, it's useless. And then here was he said, well, I was raised in this way of life, and this way of life is the only way of life I knew till I was 10 years old. And there's nothing wrong with this way of life, because it's made me who I am. And so, yeah, you know, there was no way to undermine that confidence of who he was culturally, or, you know, to affect the identity. He was, and that did make his activism sort of, it really defined his activism and his political views very much.
There are two other elements from this point of his life that I think that you described that seem to be very relevant. And the first is his participation in the dance competitions, which both gives him a chance to excel and succeed in this area of his cultural strength. And you also describe this fascinating group of which I was not really aware, which were the hobbyists, in which you have this group of white people who are passionate and supportive of this culture. And you mentioned that they're, as a group, they're controversial among the Native American community at that time, but they do also serve as another Clyde embraces them, that warrior embraces them. He's comfortable with that. And he finds that serves as another form of reinforcement of his sense of the worth of his identity as a Ponca.
Yeah, to talk about the competitions first, is that, you know, many people, and this is one of the value of being able to speak to people who knew him, in that I knew he was a dancer, and I knew he competed, and I knew he won contests. But I'd speak to people who he died in 1968, so they've not seen him or spoken to him for 40 something years. And the minute I mentioned, you know, well, what can you tell me about? Can you remember his dancing? The faces would light up. And several people described it that, you know, he was such a fluid dancer, he was almost balletic. I don't know if that's the way I pronounce it, but it was always like ballet, that he was so graceful in the arena. And again, you know, that sort of speaks to the way he was raised, but he had this natural talent as well. And with the hobbyists, one of the ways his grandparents made money was by selling drums to tourists. And So he was sort of aware of them vaguely as a child. There was a trader who used to deal with the Ponca a lot, who, as he was a young man, offered to take him out to California to, to one of his, the trader was going out there to buy and sell Indian crafts, so to speak, to the hobbyists and such, and this is how he met some of the hobbyists. And the hobbyist tradition, it comes from the Boy Scout movement, in which, again, it goes back to Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt was convinced that American men were becoming weakened by urbanization. He was a great exponent of the great outdoors. Now, he didn't start the Boy Scout movement, but it ties into that. And the early Boy Scout movement very much followed the outdoor woodsman or the Indian way of life, with the ways the kids learned. And I believe that a rite of passage for Boy Scouts in the early 20th century was an Indian ceremony. And in those days, it always used to be, it always used to be a Sioux ceremony. They would have whether it be real or not, a Lakota sort of holy man come out and perform ceremonies for them, and this would be their rite of passage. And so when Warrior encountered these hobbyists, they were all following the same standard path of dancing. Because you've got the Northern Plains. And then they met Warrior, who knew all these songs, and he was happily... again, one of the descriptions of him is that he was the only person they ever met who would whistle Indian songs just when they were driving down the street.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about him was quintessentially every part of his culture was native. We whistle pop songs as we go along, but as Clyde Warrior used to whistle Ponca songs. Mm-hmm. And so they gradually started to introduce them to a whole new realm of music that they'd never heard before. And upon the Northern Plains music is very different from Southern Plains music. And so the Ponca Southern Plains music was a whole, it was something entirely new for them, and they became very faithfully attached to Ponca songs and Ponca music, and they became very well, for a while many of them became part of the Ponca community in some ways. They were accepted by the community at large, and so it became this really somewhat unusual relationship, but it was a lasting friendship of deep respect.
Mm-hmm. Did it also play a role in sharpening his identity as an Indian as opposed to just a Ponca? The reason why I ask is because it is when you describe all of these events that he goes to, like he goes to Gallup, he goes to California, he's very well traveled for the time. And he experiences not just his culture, the Ponca culture, but he experiences the Navajo culture and the Sioux culture and all these other cultures. Uh-huh. And it seems to give him a sense of Indianness that is sort of pan-tribal.
Well, yes and no. In that one of the things he argued against, he argued vehemently against, was this idea of there being a pan-Indian identity. He went to all of these places, and again, a lot of that was largely down to his grandparents. They would travel, and they would travel to Gallup with Kiowa, with a few Kiowa friends, and so he became exposed to all these different native cultures, and so it gave him a much richer understanding of what indigenous history of America and the continent, but it also entrenched in him the understanding of how unique each culture was. So, one of the things that people said about him is he had this almost photographic memory for songs, and so he could sing. After hearing it a few times, he could sing Ponca songs, obviously, but then he could also sing you know, Lakota songs or Navajo songs or Apache songs, just a couple of listens. But he'd also, he would be able to discern nuances in the songs that other people would miss. But he was also very much vehemently against the idea of there being a single Indian culture, largely because he was so exposed to these different cultures and these different, you know, at such an early age that it reinforces identity, more and more it reinforces identity of who he was as Ponca, but what role the Ponca played in the wider sense of Indianness rather than making him more Indian. Does that make sense?
It does. And that actually, that's probably a good point now to talk a bit about these ideas that he develops during this period, the 1950s and early 1960s, as he starts to become, as he's going to high school, going to college, he's becoming more engaged. And you see, at a fair earlier point, he's beginning to formulate a lot of these ideas that he comes to become such a powerful advocate for. And I was wondering if you could speak to some of those.
Part of it, again, came from the, he was becoming more politically aware of, I mean, he seems to have been quite well read from what I understand of the 60s, that a lot of teenagers were quite well read in those days. And he was also a Bob Dylan fan, apparently, so he can't really be anything but politically aware if you're going to be a Bob Dylan fan in the 1960s. But a lot of his political work, so he had this awareness of politics and the, you know, the general political scene of the 1950s and the world and the Cold War as it was going on at the time, but also how that affected Native communities as well. And part of that comes back down to his dancing, you know, that he would go to powwows and the powwow circuit was a lot different back then, and that now it's a, you know, it's this huge circuit and some dancers can earn a lot of money on the powwow circuit. But in those days, these are the days before, you know, many of the powwows posted cash for prizes. So it was really just about the prestige. and so a lot of these reservations, and so we'd visit these reservations, and what constantly was brought home is how the poverty, you know, there's these cultural differences and very, you know, some unique languages and unique histories, even among this sort of, if you want, relentless wave of American expansion. Even, but you know, we know that American history is this sort of, it's painted as this uniform sort of history. But for each individual Native nation, there's a completely different individual history within that uniformity. And so he would recognize that, but at the same time, he would see that the common denominator everywhere was poverty and, you know, these cultural fragmentation, and you know, these pressure to sort of become Americanized and to sort of leave the identity behind because it's, you know, it's pushed as this old way. And so he's got this knowledge of the world, the outside world, and the Cold War and you know, the 1960s and the civil rights movement. But at the same time, he's seen what's happening in his own community and other communities because of his movements on the dance circuit, and he was translating the two, mm-hmm. You know. So he was interpreting, well, this is in the outside world, and this is what the outside world is doing to our world.
But you make it clear in your book that he is not simply responding to these trends. You describe, for example, how his adoption of the Red Power slogan in the fall of 1966 is practically contiguous with the invention of the Black Power slogan by Stokely Carmichael. And that is, you know, nearly a decade after he's really begun this this very assertive engagement of his identity, going back to his time at Cameron State when he started college, and he joins the Atana Indian Club, and he begins to, very early on, adopt this assertive sense of that how Indians should take charge of their own destiny and should not allow the federal government to be as assertive as they traditionally had been.
Yeah, and again, that's that reflection of seeing the poverty in the, you know, in these tribal communities is as he's gone around, and he knows the common message that's being put out to American Indians at that time, and we still hear the same message now, is that, well, it's your own fault. You know, the reason that for this poverty and the reason for this desolation in your communities is because you're not good enough and you don't do well enough and you're too lazy and so on and so forth. And he knew himself that that was not right. And because of that cultural certainty he had it within himself, you know, he didn't allow that relentless sort of push to blame American Indians for their plight. You know, it becomes internalized a lot of times. You know, in the most common sense, even sort of today, it still becomes internalized. But he refused to internalize it, so if he couldn't internalize it, then it started to be pushed back on. And when he was in those college situations, he saw a lot of other Native students who were internalizing these messages and these blame. And so he became sort of controversial even within the Native student community, because he was saying, no, we can't let them keep blaming us because this isn't our fault. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it sort of, as much as it was the political leader of the time, it was also seeing so many other Native people sort of allowing themselves, not so much allowing themselves, but, you know, internalizing this outside pressure to be blamed or to blame themselves, that sort of made him, you know, that sort of stirred his passions as much as his own culture.
You described that conference that he attends in Chicago, and how he was struck by the difference between the sort of the closed sessions where they would come together to discuss issues, and then this general session where you had this BIA personnel supervising, and the message that the leadership at the conference was giving was much more passive and not quite as assertive as it had been in the closed sessions.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's a perfect example. Behind closed doors, when there were the Declaration of Indian Purpose, which comes out of that set of those sessions, is itself quite assertive. You know, it says that, and part of it was created as a challenge to the incoming, you know, JFK. He ran on this campaign of a new frontier, and so the Native leaders were saying, well, if he's going to have a new frontier for America, there needs to be a new frontier for American Indians as well. Mm-hmm. And so the Declaration of Indian Purpose is quite assertive. But yeah, and those sessions were behind closed doors. But in the open sessions, and this is, if you think back, that this was in this whole Chicago conference occurred at a time when termination was still a federal sort of policy. And the termination, to explain it a little bit better, was the federal government was looking for ways to get out of, as they called it, the Indian problem. You know, this federal trust relationship, where in exchange for the treaty, you know, all the land that had been taken, in exchange for everything else, you know, the federal government is obligated to uphold the treaties that it signed with tribes, because treaties are legal obligations. Well, the federal government said, well, if we can terminate this trust relationship, we won't have to honor the treaties anymore, because they will agree that the relationship is over. And so many tribes would be, you know, places like Oregon and California, and so, you know, some states would set out as, we're going to terminate this relationship with those tribes. And so in the open forum, where you've got these BIA leaders and federal government officials sitting there, many of the tribal leaders didn't want to be seen to be antagonizing the federal government, in case they suddenly found that their nation was the next to be targeted for termination. But then for Warrior and the other youngsters who sort of ended up forming the National Indian Youth Council, this struck them as the most blatant form of cowardice they could see. You know, and it struck them as very much, you know, it's probably what we think of as politics. You know, it's very much the way politics is played, I think, you know, for better or worse, in any forum. But they were struck by, you know, well, in the behind closed doors, you're saying this, this, and this, and then you go out there and you don't have the courage to see their face. You know, you're okay as a part of a, saying this as part of a collective, but you don't have the courage to stand there and say it as a betrayal. And a betrayal of ancestors, a betrayal of current generations, and a betrayal of future generations. And up to this, they started to stand up and speak up themselves, but every time they did, they were told to shut up and sit down. You know, you're too young. You don't know what you're talking about. You've got no experience. You're probably communists. And so they started to have their own meetings behind closed doors, and that's where the National Indian Youth Council came from.
Could you explain a bit?
Could you
explain a bit the role of the National Indian Youth Council then within the larger, not just civil rights movement, but Native American political organizations of the 1960s? I mean, was it just sort of a fringe group, or did it really take center stage early on? And how did it present itself to the Native American community and the country as a whole?
It started off really as a they described it as a movement, but even at the beginning they wanted to maintain integrity. They wanted to ensure that they didn't fall down the same, what they saw as the same route of ultimate betrayal that they were seeing, tribal leaders, performing at the Chicago conference. And part of that, I can just go back to that for a second. Part of what the National Indian Youth Council often gets portrayed as a rebellion against their elders. But what they were so concerned about is they saw their elders, people like Warrior's grandparents, the cult of the people who held the culture for Warrior and other members of the NIYC, the National Indian Youth Council, they were the true leaders of their communities. And these political leaders who were, up there performing in front of the BIA and so on and so forth, they were either politically elected or politically appointed. And so for many, the politics was pushing aside the cultural, the people who knew the culture and the heritage and the language. And for Warrior and others, they were the real leaders and the people who really should have been listened to. And so within the National Indian Youth Council, they wanted to tap into that knowledge and that leadership and find a way to bring that leadership into the present time, rather than sort of, the political, just become, for tribes or nations to become just political, organizations. And so...
How does Clyde Warrior himself become a prominent figure within this movement, and how has he become a prominent figure nationally? Because you mentioned in the book that by the mid-1960s, he's being called to speak before Congress, he's being called to speak before all these presidential commissions. It seems that, and this is a point where he's still in his mid-20s, but he's already this very prominent figure. How does that come to pass, and what were the qualities that he had that made him such a national figure?
I think that was part of the beauty of the National Indian Youth Council. For the first couple of years, they started to tour. There were roughly about 3,000 American Indian students in university in the entire country in 1960-61. That was a very small number, but they were spread right across the nation. And each of these, they have student organizations, they have these, the same as the Anaha Club or the Sequoia Club in Cameron and the University of Oklahoma. And so over the first couple of years, the National Indian Youth Council was just going, was just visiting their annual youth conferences and talking and trying to build up, membership and support. There was the workshop on American Indian Affairs that happened in Boulder, Colorado, every summer. They were very much a part of that, and very much made that place their own for a few years. And within the workshops on American Indian Affairs, it was run by Darcy McNichol. And Darcy McNichol was also one of the founding members of the National Congress of American Indians. And so the National Indian Youth Council found themselves sort of playing politics with the National Congress of American Indians to a certain degree. And so that, because the National Congress of American Indians had been the idea originally of John Collier, who was Bureau of who was Commissioner of Indian Affairs up until 1945. There was a certain cachet with the National Congress of American Indians. They already had connections with the broader the more traditional political scene, as we would think, Washington, D.C. and what have you. And so the National Indian Youth Council sort of used that as a way in. But because they were young and they were outspoken and they were not following traditional methods, they started to attract the attention of politicians, of the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, education leaders. And they focused a lot on education as well, and education reform. So they really wanted to change how American Indians were being educated. And so their ideas were such that they sort of forced people to listen to them. And again, Warrior, many people said that he just had this force of personality where no matter how many people were in the room, he was one of those people that when he walked into a room, everybody sort of turned and looked. He had that sort of magnetic personality where everybody was drawn to him. And so even though in the very initial meetings of the National Indian Youth Council, he was nominating, he was pushing everybody else to the forefront. And he was very much unsure of having a national organization was the best way to go. He was very much against the idea, uncertain in the original very early meetings of what's this going to become? What's this organization going to become? Are we just going to use it to feather our own nests? Or are we actually going to try and make change? And the idea of an actual structural organization that mirrored other organizations didn't really appeal to him at the beginning. And so he pushed other people into positions of power and said, I'm just going to speak, but I don't want... And so he sort of he evolved into a leadership. As he said himself later on, in Native communities, and this was part of the distrust of the political leadership as well, in Native communities, traditionally, you didn't appoint yourself. The community chose you from within. Leadership was something that the community saw and the community bestowed leadership upon people rather than people appoint themselves as leaders or, nominate themselves for leadership roles. And so that sort of, again, it sounds sort of cliche, but it very much, again, mirrors his cultural upbringing and that he was pushed into this leadership role rather than trying to assert himself. He never once ever accepted that he was a leader. He was always sort of reject that term upon himself, but he was a leader, but he didn't ever really think of himself as such.
He also was not just a leader during this period, but he's also a very prominent publicist, for lack of a better word. He's on the radio, he's publishing articles. Sometimes it's just within, say, small community sheets, but he's writing as well, and he's getting his word out that way. He's getting his message out that way as well.
Yeah, he was very much, a philosopher as well as an activist. And he was always thinking and taking ideas and trying to build on them and to think of ways that Native people could be uplifted. And that was always sort of at the central. Everything was about how Native people, whether as distinct communities or as a whole, could be uplifted and put themselves in a position of true self-determination and true self-control.
But it wasn't just...
So that was very much sort of...
It wasn't just theory, though, because you described that after he graduates and he... from college, he begins to get involved in the Cherokee educational system, and he begins doing research on these problems and trying to devise solutions from that experience rather than just from some sort of utopian ideal.
Oh, no, yeah, he very much applied himself to two finding solutions and two, philosopher, activist, I don't think of the word. he very much has immersed himself in the nuts and bolts of trying to make these things happen. Yeah, so, I mean, again, that's why he didn't really think of himself as much as a leader, as everybody needs to pitch in together. And again, it's that sense of community and communal, everybody works for the greater good rather than working for themselves was very much a part of how he was raised. And so, it was a natural extension of who he was that he never thought of himself. He never put himself first. It was always for the greater good of American Indians.
And yet
that's something Clive...
go ahead.
I was going to say, that's something Mel Tom said after Clive died. He said that our leader has left us. And you think that's a very much in and of itself a statement, because going back to the beginning of National Indian Youth Council, it was Mel Tom that Warrior said should be the leader. And yet here, less than a decade later, Mel Tom was saying to him, he is our leader. But he also said within that same statement that this is a guy who would never have accepted a penny for himself if he knew other Native people were still poor.
Mm-hmm. And yet that... those roles that he assumed, the roles not just in the public sphere, but he was also a husband and a father, that took a real toll on him, because he died at such a tragically young age. He died before he even turned 30 years old.
Yeah, and his widow is still convinced, and it's not a hard thing to buy into, but to except maybe a reality, is that he had health issues that were a lot. People always put it down to the fact he drank, and he drinking was a way of life. A lot of people in that era, most political deals were done over in smoky back rooms over bottles of whiskey and so on. So it's not as if I think people make a lot of his alcoholism in a certain degree because he's Native American and he can just fit that stereotype. That's not denying that he did drink. But his widow also said, given with the Ponca are, and given that the Ponca water has been polluted for generations by the oil refinery in Ponca City, and the air around there, you can't really breathe without breathing in the oil. And there is a lot of other related forms of illness in the Ponca, then there is a possibility that there were other things, there were other overriding health issues that contributed to his early death, but they never really got investigated. But at the same time, he was spread extremely thin, and that he was an activist, a leader, a student, a father, a son, a researcher, a diplomat, I suppose, if you will, to the federal government. So he was constantly on the move.
What would you say is his legacy to not just the Native American community, but to American history as a whole?
To American history as a whole, he forces us to rethink American Indian history, for one, as I said earlier, the traditional history still talks about the civil rights era, and American Indians are largely absent. And when they do come under discussion, it's normally that the Red Power era itself began in 1969 with the occupation of Alcatraz, and then ended in 1975 after the Siege at Wounded Knee and the court cases that followed. And yeah, here we have someone who sort of set the ball rolling a whole decade earlier and actually coined the term Red Power and created a lot of the ideologies of what Red Power meant. And at the same time was connected with the outside world in ways that people still don't seem to understand American Indians as being. You know, and within American history itself, it gives this proves here in, you know, in 1890 after Wounded Knee, that they weren't passive people, you know, sort of clinging to a past that no longer existed, that these cultures and these identities and these histories are still being played out now. They still exist and they still thrive. And Clyde Warrior is an example of that. The 1950s is when many people say American Indian nations were probably at their weakest because of termination. And yet you had youngsters who, like Clyde Warrior, pushing through and fighting back. But there was also an awareness that, you know, he deliberately kept the American Indian rights movement away from the civil rights movement because he was politically astute enough that he knew that if they allowed themselves to become co-opted with the wider social movements of the time, that they would be subsumed by the civil rights movement.
Well, you point out in your book that the native, that the Red Power movement was had a very different set of needs than the Black Power movement. That for African Americans, there was part this grasping of this heritage that they had really put behind them, and Clyde Warrior recognized that the Native Americans already had that. They were kind of in a different stage.
Yeah. But there was a lot of pressure as well within people to say, well, we just need to join up with the civil rights movement because they're getting all the newspaper and they're getting all the attention. And he kept on pushing back and saying, but the newspaper and the attention is not enough. You know, the attention is not enough to sacrifice what we're actually fighting for. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think what also one of his legacies as well is he died in 1968. And since then, we've had self-determination in 1975, in which, you know, American Indian nations were given the right to self-govern. Or not given the right, but, you know, the federal government created space where to recognize American Indians as sovereign nations and you know, establish this space of self-governance. But even within this space of self-governance since 1975, many of the issues that Clyde Warrior was calling out and fighting against still exist. And so, you know, 60 years later, much of his words and much of his arguments are still as relevant today as they were then, which tells us that, you know, we sort of congratulate ourselves to a certain degree, and we've been more open and accepting, and we don't treat Indians the way we used to. But a lot of that is superficial, and in many ways, we still treat them exactly the same way we did 60 years ago, which is exactly the way we treated them 60 years before that. We've just sort of changed the way we do it slightly. And so there's a lot of lessons to be learned in there as well. Of the you know, his words then reflect on us still now.
Hmm. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I've actually just put I've compiled all of his essays and his notes from those student research. So that's actually with the OU Press at the minute. They're evaluating whether, you know, I'm hoping that will come out as a book. The OU Press is currently evaluating that right now. Apart from that, my next research project is I'm working on transnational activism from the crosses borders. So I'm looking at it comes from a research on Clyde Warriors that he was a lot of the people he connected with are what were First Nations, Canadian First Nations activists. And, you know, it's Indigenous people in the United States, Indigenous people in Canada, who existed long before the United States or Canada did, but now we have them completely categorically separated by a border that we imposed upon them. And a lot of their activism transcends this border, and there are still connections they make with each other and have made with each other that sort of undercut what the border means. And so that's what I'm working on now, is putting together analyzing these movements where they collaborated across the border for a common cause, despite the fact they're fighting against or the negotiating with completely different federal governments.
Sounds like a fascinating project.
Well, I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Well, Professor Mackenzie Jones, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us today about the life of Clyde Warrior. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you so much.